What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Timothy King. So this is a powerful episode because Tim comes on and he talks about his story of addiction after going through some medical, really extreme medical things in his 20s. He found himself in the position of being addicted to his pain medicine. And so we talk about that. We talk about the why behind that. And I think for an episode like this, I want to start thinking about work much more broad than just the way we make money. I want to think about work in this way we interact with the world, how we bring the kingdom into this world. And unfortunately, addiction is part of that. We all go through that, especially through a pandemic. Like, these things are just becoming even more prevalent now, and it's getting worse. And so we talk about the opioid addiction in our country, the deaths from that, and just why all these things are coming together and how we ought to think about them as Christians. And so there is so much in this episode. Tim, his book called Addiction Nation details a lot of this stuff, dives deep into this. So if this is something that interests you, something you want to think more about, I cannot recommend his book highly enough. It is so well done, and it's so personal to him. I think Tim can tell this story and have these conversations in a way that most can't, because he has lived it and he is passionate about these things and about helping people, the common good here. So this is a great one. I can't wait for you to hear it. Before we get started, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with what we got going on the podcast, the awesome episodes coming out. And yeah, I really hope you enjoy hearing from Tim. All right, Tim, well, thanks so much for making time for me and coming on the podcast, man.
Thanks so much for having me on.
It's I'm excited to chat. Let's go ahead and just maybe get started with your story. Can you tell us just a little bit about yourself, the quick rundown?
Yeah, so grew up here in New Hampshire, where I live now, evangelical home, went to an evangelical college, worked at an evangelical summer camp, and at the same time hit that time in college where I was asking a lot of questions about my faith and how does it apply in the world? What does it look like, not just for me and focus on a personal transformation, but what does that look like applied? And especially I was going to school in Chicago and thinking about, okay, what does my faith look like in the context of homelessness? Something that I hadn't experienced growing up on a farm in New Hampshire. That led me to Washington, D.C., was working at an organization called Sojourners for about 7 years. And a few years in, I had a moment where I woke up in the middle of the night with severe stomach pain. Go into the emergency room, find out that I have pancreatitis. Unusual for a 25-year-old to have pancreatitis, so the doctors start doing lots of tests, trying to figure out what's going on, and one of those tests goes wrong. So the next thing I know, I'm going from 25, being relatively healthy, running every day, enjoying my job. I'm in the ICU. My organs are shutting down. I'm in acute respiratory distress, and the doctors are calling my family to come in and potentially say goodbye. Mm. And that was a turning point. Something that I didn't realize at the time, but after a few months in the hospital, I developed something that I didn't expect and didn't know, and it was another life-threatening complication, and that was an opioid addiction. And it was a story I did not tell or talk about for years. And it wasn't until I moved back to my home state of New Hampshire and started to hear the stories of, it seemed like every week, there was somebody who would, you know, shoot an email like, oh, did you hear? That guy in our class, he passed away of an overdose. Or you hear about, you know, a home down the road that you thought was just this quiet home suddenly explode because there was something going on and addiction was present there. Mm. And it was a story of in my life that I hadn't thought I would ever need to revisit until I started hearing all the people who were affected and started to ask the question, why didn't that happen to me? Why am I here now? Why am I in a stable place? Why aren't I still addicted to opioids? And that was a turning point.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a powerful story. I can't wait to dig into it. Before I forget, where did you go to school in Chicago?
North Park University.
Ah, nice. I went to Moody, so I was just south of you there.
Yeah, wonderful schools, and I don't know, one of my favorite professors there, Scott McKnight. I was his teacher's assistant for a while and somebody who helped form my early understanding of scripture.
That's awesome. I love North Park. We used to travel, take the Brown Line up to North Park to go to the hang out at the library there when I was an undergrad. So,
oh man, yeah, I did not realize North Park Library was the place to go.
Listen, Moody is a very small, very difficult bubble to live in. So you kind of did anything, you know. The library was also like pretty magnificent compared to ours. You know, ours is like in a little basement. I mean, yeah. So. Any excuse to sort of see the city too. So, yeah. Sweet. So when were you there at North Park?
I was there, 2003 to 2006. I had actually started off, I'd gone to a small Bible college in Colorado for my freshman year and then transferred to North Park.
Okay. So did you graduate high school in 2001?
It would have been 2002.
Yeah. Okay. So I was at Moody from 2003 to 2006 and had gone to a little college before that.
So any chance that you ever slept out on the streets in downtown Chicago with North Park students?
I did not.
That's the only time I met Moody students was we got a bunch of people together to sleep out in the middle of winter in downtown Chicago.
Yeah, the homelessness. The homelessness thing, it really resonates with me just – my experience in Moody, you know, I'm from small town Texas, and like being in the city and having to sort of face homelessness literally every day, like anytime you went anywhere, you know, worked at Starbucks, and you just like you get to know actual people, not just like, just the homeless. You get to know them, you know, the people themselves, and it changes you, I think. So,
yeah. And that was. I had what I called my Christian version of Cartesian doubt, where sure. I went through the Bible in college and I was like, all right, is there anything here that even if the Bible was completely made up, nothing else about it is true, is there anything here that no matter what, I would take away from it? Mm. And I realized that no matter what, I would still want to live my life loving my neighbor as myself. And so I decided in college to say, all right, so how about I focus on that? And it was one night we were down handing out bags of food as like part of a college ministry program and handed out some food on Lower Wacker Drive, that, you know, series of roads beneath downtown Chicago. Yeah. And there's one guy, he looks at me and he's just like, thanks, man, but you don't really understand homelessness, do you, kid? I was like, I guess that's fair, farm kid from New Hampshire.
Right.
And he said, how about you come spend the night out on the streets with me? And I was like, all right, I'll do it. Like, for me, it's like, this is the most practical application of loving my neighbor as myself. I was just invited to spend the night with this guy. And I had about $7 in my pocket. And this is, of course, pre-cell phone, like didn't have my own cell phone at the time.
Right.
So I got $7 in my pocket. And I just figured, I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll go buy a pack of Marlboro Reds. Not a smoker, but I knew that that would be like the perfect currency. And so the van I was with, they all go back to school. I say, hey, I'll be fine. And so then I go back to find the guy who had offered to host me for the night, and he was gone. So now all I have is a pack of Marlboro Reds. No phone, no change, nothing else. And I just sit down in Lower Wacker Drive, and I was like, well, these aren't going to smoke themselves. So I pull out a cigarette, and I just start to smoke. And the next thing I know, I have a guy who comes up, and he's just like, hey, can I bum a square? I was like, sure. Then somebody else walks, hey, can I too? Soon I have about 6 or 7 homeless people all around me smoking my pack of Marlboro Reds. When one of them finally looks, goes, what are you doing down here? And I was like, well, I was supposed to spend the night, like he invited me to spend the night on the streets to learn more about homelessness. And he was just like, oh yeah, he probably took off on you, didn't you? And one of them like steps up and he goes, I'll take you around tonight, kid. So we spent the whole night walking around and fell asleep that night on a cardboard box. And that for me was a way of, you know, figuring out what do I really believe, and starting with the most practical of, I want to learn how to love my homeless neighbor.
Hmm. Wow. That is a hilarious slash powerful story, all at the same time. So, yeah, you're not going to get that in New Hampshire, I don't think. So, you know, that experience. So we're here talking about your book, Addiction Nation, which just came out. It's awesome. I recommend everybody reading it. But your experience is leading us into like a much bigger problem, and one that I think probably is easy to ignore, maybe, or pretend like when it's out there, it's easy to like leave out there. So can you just talk about sort of the overarching problem that your book is sort of even working toward?
Yes, yeah, so the statistics just on their face are devastating, and it's getting worse. When I wrote my book, we were hitting record numbers of about 70,000 overdoses in 1 year. They're still estimating for 2020, but we're probably going to be hitting anywhere between 85,000 and 100,000 overdoses in 2020. Because wow. The pandemic is making every factor that contributes to addiction is making it worse.
Right.
And so we have this wave of deaths that's happening every year. We now have had way more people die from overdoses than died in the Vietnam and Korean Wars combined. This is something that is so, it has, before the pandemic started, it was one of the forces that was actually decreasing average life expectancy in America. And for folks in our age category, young men under the age of 40, this is one of the leading causes of accidental death. Mm. And it is something that, because of the stigma around addiction, we hear about it in the news, but this had been going on since the 1970s. We've been in an upward trend of overdoses since the 1970s. And it was only in 2016 that you started to see people really even paying attention to it. And even today, after it's been in the headlines, it's been in the news, people probably seen a documentary about it or read an article about it. It's still something that on an individual level, there is still so much shame associated with it that oftentimes the people who are struggling with it can't talk about it or don't know how to talk about it. And if you go in and if you've got somebody in your family who develops cancer, right, it's tragic and it's sad, it's challenging, it's difficult. But oftentimes, if you're a part of a church community, people know what to do in that situation.
Right.
I've heard it called like the casserole response. People get, all right, someone's sick, and we respond by supporting them with meals. We ask them what they need. And even that can be challenging when someone's in the midst of pain.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit more of a context for how to respond and how to help someone in that situation. When someone's got a child who's struggling with an opioid addiction or a methamphetamine addiction or cocaine addiction, alcohol, any of those things, those conversations suddenly become a lot harder.
Right.
And, you know, we understand there's an easier conversation about, you know, it's sad that people need to start a GoFundMe campaign sometimes to pay for cancer treatment. But there are people who are going bankrupt, cashing in their retirement savings to try to pay for treatment for a loved one.
Yeah.
And these are all challenges that we have so often wondered, what is wrong with the individual? What is wrong with the person who is experiencing that addiction? And in this book, I wanted to say, yes, we see the tragic nature of this. We see how bad it is. But what does this say about us? What does this say about us as a society? What does this say about our laws? What does this say about our economics? What does this say about our spirituality? What does this say about all of us that so many people are dying? And that's the question that I think we need to continue to engage in if we're going to see any sort of shift. Because as long as we think of those who struggle with addiction as kind of these anomalous people out there, then we are never going to see the solutions. And that's where my story is one of something that went right. I experienced the addiction, but I did not have a long downward trend. Not because I was so smart, not because I had such great will or willpower or strength. It was because I had things that other people didn't. And I believe that if everyone had the kind of support that I had, we would not be in the place we are today.
Yeah. I think the crazy part about the book is just how many facets it really does hit. You know, it's like all of these places are part of the problem and part of what's going on. But even our mentality and our understanding of addiction is a major problem to these hurdles, where we had, you know, one sort of model for understanding addiction that's now changed. But like, it's like, I think most people don't even know how to think through addiction and who's actually responsible for addiction. Can you talk a little bit about some of that?
Yeah, it might be great to illustrate that just with a little bit of my own story. So I'm in the hospital for months, and I have all these complications, but each time I keep having pain and I'm asking for more pain medicine. I had on three separate occasions doctors say, "We don't think anything's wrong with you. You're just seeking the medication now." And they were rude about it, they were aggressive about it, and they were dismissive and made me feel terrible. And each time they had missed a complication that was actually causing that pain. And so that's where, and I try to emphasize this too, me being prescribed that pain medicine in that situation was the appropriate medical response. Like, these drugs do have a role in keeping people alive and helping people heal. And they have a container that when they are used in that, they can be beneficial for our health and well-being. You don't want surgery without fentanyl. Like, that's not fun. Like, you don't want to recover from surgery without some sort of narcotic. Those are an important part of the medical mix. But what happened for me was I went from a simple physical dependency. So physical dependency is different than addiction. That's when your body becomes accustomed to a certain thing. That's when you get a headache if you don't have your cup of coffee in the morning. That's a physical dependency. And I went from a physical dependency to an addiction where, when I was sent home, my brain had so closely associated that sense of relief from pain with also relieving anxiety, with making me feel better about the fact that I had just missed out on a whole bunch of stuff I'd been looking forward to in my work and professional life. And I was feeling alone and isolated, and my entire life had been paused. The drugs were providing a temporary sense of relief for all of those things.
Right.
And so I wasn't aware when I started to go from a basic, like, taking my pills as prescribed to, I was like, I just need a little more and a little more. And I suddenly, my usage went from regulated and like systematic to something I felt I lost control of. And this is where my story, I think, diverges from so many others. I went in to see my pancreatic specialist, who was not an addiction specialist, but he was the doctor who was working on my case. And he looked at my charts, and he looked at how quickly my medications were running out. And he sat me down and he said, "Tim, you need to know you're addicted to your pain medicine." And as soon as those words came out of his mouth, I was ready to fight him. I had all of my defenses were there. I was primed to tell him all of the reasons why I was not addicted and why I was still in pain, because what I had in my head was the moral model of addiction. And that is that the people who get addicted, it's a sign of an underlying moral flaw. Yeah. It's a sign of an underlying moral depravity. And so how do you know someone's a bad person? Well, you can see it because they're addicted. Because good people don't get addicted. And I had that so deeply ingrained in my head. Even though if you'd asked me, I probably would never have said that. But it was just so deep in there culturally, that what I heard him say was not, "You're addicted." I heard him say, "Tim, you're bad." And that produced a defensiveness in me, which is why it was so important that the next words out of his mouth were, "And you didn't do anything wrong." Hmm. And I felt myself breathe out, and relax. And then I could hear the next words that he said were, "And I believe that you're still in pain." Because where my mind went immediately was, I need to prove to him I'm in pain. And when you feel like you need to prove you're in pain, there's no time you feel your pain more. Right. It's part of how pain works.
Yeah.
And so he acknowledged too that there was an ambivalence in how I was relating to my pain medicine. There was the positive part where it really did make me temporarily feel better. But then there was the negative part of I was using more and more of it. And at that point too, I was using so much. I wasn't able to eat anything by mouth at this point. I was hooked up to an IV for 12 hours a day to get all of my nutrition. And when I was trying to eat normally, when I was trying to drink normally, I would have more pain. And that was actually because I was on so much pain medicine, I had what they called gastric paresis, which meant that the narcotics were numbing my digestive system. So when I tried to use it again, it was causing more pain, which caused me to take more pain medicine, which made my stomach worse. So I was in this negative feedback loop that I couldn't identify on my own. But he saw it and he acknowledged, "Tim, you're not a bad person. And in fact, I know that you probably have a good motivation for why you want this pain medicine. You're still in pain." And then he asked something that I did not expect at all from a pancreatic specialist. And he said, he asked me, "What does a good life look like for you in the next 5 years?"
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, you know, "Well, I want to go back to work, and I'd like to write a book someday and like to do," and started describing it to him. And he goes, "Great. So when you imagine yourself in that future, are you still on pain medicine?" It's like, "No, I'm not." "Oh, well, that's fantastic. Then we're on the same page. Mm-hmm. Now we just need to work together to achieve your goal." And so what he did there was flip it from, "I am the director. I am telling you what is right or wrong, and I will enforce this in your life," to drawing out of me what I truly wanted, and then stepping in as a partner to say, "How do we achieve that together?" And going now through the research, when we think of addiction as a moral failing, then that negative response, that response that relies on negative consequences, on shame, that's the place you're going to go. But if you can see addiction, you know, one of the dominant frameworks right now is addiction as a disease, and that has a lot of good ways that helps us understand addiction and the ways that it changes the brain. There's other models of addiction that also help us understand some of the other psychological, some of the social factors that are important to bring in too. And he completely reframed the situation from me as someone who he needed to control and stop to someone that he could partner with to help me achieve my goals and to let me slowly step down from that pain medication to work with a cognitive behavioral therapist to understand more about my cravings and how that was functioning inside of my brain and inside of my body. And that was such a big shift from how people are normally treated and how I was treated.
Yeah. I mean, did your doctor like moonlight as a therapist or something? I mean, that's a lot of like emotional intelligence to have in a doctor.
Well, and that's, I did not get what happened there until I was in the midst of research for this book. And I got to sit down with a guy named Dr. William Miller, who's the co-founder of an approach to addiction called motivational interviewing.
Hmm.
And I sat down and started reading his stuff and knew I was going to get to sit down and interview him. And I was like, "Wait a minute. I think my doctor went to a motivational interviewing like conference or something," or because he followed it to a T, where it is that flipping on its head. And how Dr. Miller developed this was he accidentally got an internship working with people struggling with alcohol one summer. And it wasn't what he had intended to go into, so he hadn't read any literature on alcoholism. And so he didn't know that alcoholics were supposed to be bad people, which was the dominant thought at the time.
Sure.
He didn't know that they were supposed to be liars and deceit. And so he just sat down and got to know them. And he also said, "Well, I didn't really know what I was doing, so I just asked them about themselves and what they wanted in their lives." And they had great results because he started without those preconceived notions. And he assumed these are good people who have important stories and need someone to talk to. And that was, for him, that germ of developing a very new approach to addressing addiction, and suddenly put into context for me what happened with that doctor that day. And that's, you know, as an aside to anyone in your, you know, audience who is in any kind of ministry or in any place where they are regularly in contact with people who are struggling with addiction or know they might be, a one-day seminar on motivational interviewing can transform your approach. And that does not make you a qualified addiction counselor, but it can make you a point of first contact, like my doctor was, who can successfully hand off somebody to who is that addiction counselor or can provide those more advanced services they might need.
Sweet. That's awesome. I love that. I think I'll put links in the show notes to that, so people can kind of find out about more of that. That's great stuff. Yeah. And we talk about the support that you had. I mean, not only was this doctor forthright with you and played this not from a perspective of you're a bad person in need of like me confronting, but you're a whole person who needs help, right? But you also had family who were in the medical profession, like in different places. I mean, you had support upon support around you. And I think of some of some of the people that just in my life that I've known who have struggled with addiction. I mean, you take that scenario and you put yourself on like government assistance, you know, as opposed to like, you know, having insurance, and you play this out in a different person's shoes, and things could turn out significantly different, right?
Dramatically so. And, you know, not just, and that's something that everything that I had does not guarantee. Like, you can come from a loving home with lots of support, and there's going to be different traumas and there's going to be different triggers. But one of the greatest examples of this was over in Vietnam. So at Vietnam, right next to the Golden Triangle, which at the time was the world's greatest region for producing heroin. And estimates have that up to 25% of American service members over in Vietnam had not just tried heroin, but were fully blown addicted to it. And when they were trying to provide treatment to soldiers in Vietnam, it was only 5% success rate. Most people went right back to their previous usage. And so the government was starting to prepare for this big wave of people coming back. And there, sure enough, there were some people who came back and still used. But what they found after 2 years, that 95% of people simply went back to whatever their previous drug usage was when they were in the United States before going over to Vietnam. Because when you put somebody in that position, right, there's stories of water buffalo in Vietnam who would just graze, you know, calmly and peacefully. And then as soon as bombs started to drop nearby, they would break down fences and go into poppy fields and start eating the opium poppies. Mm. Why? Because they were stressed. And it was a natural response to try to relieve that stress, that uncertainty, that feeling of danger. And so you think about that today, you've got a town in Ohio, factories closed, somebody who's working there for 30 years, busts their back, they're in constant back pain. And now they don't have a job. And that job that gave them purpose, that job that gave them meaning, that job that made them feel like they were a provider, now they're home. They don't have that job. And the one thing that they have is a bottle of pills that makes them feel better about their pain for a little bit, but also makes them feel a sense of peace for just a little while. And one of the interesting things, like, in order for a drug to be a drug, there needs to be something in the brain that receives something like it already, right? Because if it's completely foreign, it's just not going to have any effect on the brain because there's nothing for the brain to bring it in. And so that's, you know, referred to a substance then crosses the blood-brain barrier. Now it's affecting your brain. And with opioids in particular, there's endorphins, the molecules of emotion. It's what makes us feel a sense of intimacy, love, and connection between partners to each other or between a parent and a child. And they were discovered in the 1970s. And the researcher who discovered them named them endorphins, combining the two words endogenous and morphine. Because when he saw them, he said, oh, this is the body's natural morphine. And so when you take an opioid, the primary experience, it's acting on those receptors that make you feel love and intimacy. So it's no surprise to me right now, in a country where we are increasingly isolated, and especially now with the pandemic, where people are further away from each other, they have fewer of those communities of connection and purpose and meaning, that the drug people are turning to is the one that makes them feel love for a second.
Yeah. Yeah, when you talked about Vietnam and people coming back and that, like, the addiction statistics, it, like, that is unbelievable. That is, and all it was changing the environment and the stressors that were present upon them. I mean, they weren't like doing anything actively to get rid of these addictions, right?
And, you know, we look back and we see that in Vietnam, and then we see the rise of addiction today.
Yeah.
And it does raise that question, what is in our environment that is causing this? And this is, you know, the old story of canaries in the coal mine. The miners, right, who would go down, they'd bring that canary. And the canary with its sensitive respiratory system, if the canary stopped singing, if the canary fell to the bottom of the cage, you don't ask what's wrong with the canary. You know something's wrong in the environment.
Right.
And even if I'm not feeling it yet, if the canary is, then that's a sign that something is starting to happen to me. And I think what we saw, especially when we see, like, in the 1980s and how the crack epidemic was addressed, right? There's a writer, Brian Broom, he just summed it up. He said, right now, still today in America, black means addict and white means victim.
Right.
And that disparity is tragic. And we saw how that played out because we had a war on people. And instead of asking what's going on in these, you know, city centers where people are feeling like they don't have control in their lives, people feeling like they don't have agency, why is it that crack cocaine is taking off? Because the peak for per capita cocaine usage did not happen in the 1980s. It was happening in the 1970s when it was primarily powder cocaine with white people using it.
Right.
So we had a lower per capita usage of cocaine in the 1980s, but it was happening in these poor urban areas. And it's like we looked at a canary in the coal mine and said, what's wrong with you? While not realizing that the entire environment was toxic to us all. And that our failure in addressing the crack epidemic, it had the direct injustice of creating mass incarceration, of burning out entire neighborhoods. But it also now has that ripple of effect of that was our understanding of how to address addiction. And now we have the rise of the opioid crisis, and we're seeing these same environmental factors that a little bit of money can protect you from some of these things for a little while, but it doesn't mean we're in a healthy environment. It doesn't mean that we are helping people thrive, and it doesn't mean that people aren't going to turn to substances to medicate what's going on in their hearts and their lives, and to deal with trauma, to deal with stress, to deal with feeling dislocated from a sense of place. These are all factors that people are going to pretty naturally turn to these substances. And that's where addiction, instead of being thought of as an aberration, can be thought of as a relatively predictable response to being in high stress or dangerous environments. Or environments in which you feel insecure over time, that this is something that would happen to most of us if being put in the wrong situation.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And one we don't give enough credence to, I think, in our everyday lives. And I'm speaking for all people everywhere. But I think, you know, we see that the addiction is out there, right? Those people struggle with it instead of sort of bringing it home and feeling like what we should be doing about it, or how we can affect this, like, change in these areas. Yeah. And I mean, you brought in a whole nother aspect of this thing, which is the justice system and how we've used the justice system in order to like crack down on these things, like through the war on drugs, but which is still going on today, you know, even as marijuana gets legalized in all these states, how many people have been put in prison for long periods of time because of a now legal substance, you know, is just sort of mind boggling, I think. So
that's our, you know, criminal justice approach. It isn't just that it isn't very effective. It is actively contributing to the problem. There was a study done in Baltimore of IV drug users for over 10 years, and they were looking at all the different factors that might affect whether or not someone continues to use. And they were really hoping to find that some of their programs were working. But when the data came in, the only consistent conclusion they could say with confidence was that if you had gone to prison, you were more likely to continue using drugs than if you never went to prison at all. Gosh. Because prison is traumatizing.
Mm-hmm.
Prison is isolating. Prison is taking you out of a normal sense of life and community. It's limiting your choices for the future. And we know this not just because of the negative consequences we see in the United States, but we can also look at countries that have taken a different approach. Portugal, over 15 years ago, decided to decriminalize all drugs. And instead of focusing all of their money on enforcement, they said, why don't we treat this not as a supply problem, but a demand problem? And if we can address the demand problem, the supply problem will take care of itself. And of course, there was an international outcry. Can't do this. Portugal is going to go downhill. It's going to be a terrible country. I mean, it had just come out of a very dictatorial government. It had been devastated by that previous regime. Mm. People were hopeless. The economy was in shambles. And it's like, and now you're going to decriminalize drugs? Way right. to make the problem worse, guy. Well, we now have the numbers. These are 2017 numbers, so they're a few years out of date, but I was reading through and I was like, wow, like not bad at the time, you know, when they made this decision, a higher percentage of people in Portugal were using IV heroin than even today in the United States.
Wow.
On a per capita basis. And 2017 numbers for overdoses in Portugal was 6 per million. The EU average was 26 per million. So that's already a lot better than the EU as a whole. And I first read these numbers and I'm trying to go through, I was like, what was the US? Like 31.6 per million? And then I look it up and I was like, oh, the United States stopped counting per million and we count per 100,000. So the numbers are 6 per million, 26 per million, and 316 per million. And that's in 2017 when our numbers were under 70,000 overdoses per year.
Wow.
So the difference has been dramatic. And the architect of this policy, he said, it's not just about the decriminalization, it's about the destigmatization.
Mm.
It's about people feeling free to come forward and say, yeah, if you need insulin because you have diabetes, you're not going to hesitate if it's available to you. That's not a place of shame. That's not a place of hesitate. Like, you can go and get the insulin you need. Hopefully that's not always the case, but you'd hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what happens in Portugal. Mm. And people can get access to the help that they need, even in the midst of while they're still using drugs, they are able to access ways to use them in a way that are less likely to spread HIV/AIDS, less likely to hurt them. If you talk to any ER professional, right, they're not just seeing people who are overdosing and taking too much. They're seeing people who have infections, right? They're seeing people who are dying because of infections in their blood and in their heart. That's a lot of what's killing people. And in Portugal, they flipped it on its head, and now they had a whole bunch of extra money that they could spend on treatment, that they could spend on helping people get jobs, they could spend on helping people get housing, and it's worked. And in the United States, we still default, even if someone says, yeah, you know, end the war on drugs. Yeah, it's a public health crisis, not a moral failing. We still default to this prison system.
Yeah.
And for me, it's baffling as a Christian. Well, I shouldn't say baffling because I was there before, right? This is not something that I knew all along. So I shouldn't say baffling. I should say it's very understandable.
Yeah.
But once you start to flip it, and I think about my own faith, what I believe as a Christian is that the most transformative thing I will ever experience is not all of the consequences of my own actions.
Mm.
It's being given grace. It's the fact that the heart of what I believe is that I don't get everything I deserve. That there is Jesus who flipped the script and said, what's going to change you is not you getting punished for everything. It is you receiving this gift of grace in your life. Mm. And we think of that sometimes. I think it's so narrow of like, that's something special that just happened 2,000 years ago, instead of thinking of the fact that that describes reality.
Yeah.
That describes how we function as humans, how the world functions, is that we all benefit from that grace. Mm. And that's something that we can apply. That's not just a prayer we say to receive, but that's something that we can apply on a day-to-day basis. And it's part of our then imitation and following that. And it's part of our own taking up the cross, is to then imitate that in our own lives and to invite others into the community that can build. And as we think about these justice systems, we need to think about how do people actually work. And what we see time and time again is that punishment, blame, stigma, those are some of the least powerful ways that people change. Those are some of the hardest to sustain, because the threat of an outside force, right? If someone's actively using drugs right now, they are well aware of how many people are dying around them.
Right.
We can't, we can't match the amount of death that is caused right now by these substances as punishment. And if that isn't working, then that means we are using the wrong tool for the wrong problem.
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, that's the gospel, and to not bring that into the way we treat, like, why would we as Christians receive so much grace, right? I'm pretty sure there's a parable about this, and then go and punish people for what they've done, right? I mean, that's like very central to the gospel, Jesus' own words. So I think that's a needed message and such a powerful thing. So, I mean, you know, around addiction, right? There's a lot of shame, you know, a lot of pain. I mean, all this stuff is what sort of like exacerbates the issue, right? So what made you step forward and like actually talk about this when it would be a lot easier to sort of hide these things?
I realized that the narratives that were so powerfully ingrained in my own mind, that I wasn't the only one. And those narratives of, you know, moral failing, that was present as an undercurrent in all these stories. And that the most powerful way to try to shift those narratives was to, you know, speak out in my own story. And it was, you know, a process of going through of when I first wrote about this, it was a piece in Christianity Today. And I had that moment where I realized, now for the rest of my life, if anyone types my name into Google, the first things that are going to come up is me being labeled as someone who is addicted to opioids. And that was concerning, but at the same time, again, you know, how do I follow the example of Jesus, who was unafraid to be labeled hanging out with the sinners and the drunkards? Yeah. And, you know, that was something that Jesus readily stepped into, and something that I was hoping to say, yeah, you know, that's a label that I am willing to have people put on me if it helps them better understand others who are in the midst of this struggle. Because there is, especially if someone's close to you and you've watched them struggle and go back and forth, it can be very demoralizing. And it can feel like there isn't hope, and that you're just stuck in, right, that this is a Sisyphean task, that there is a boulder that you're pushing up the hill, and you're just going to push it up again again tomorrow. And that can feel the way that way in the midst of it, but it actually isn't the case with a lot of addictions, especially with opioid addictions. One of the interesting things is someone goes to treatment, and if you're counting success as that person will never ever use again, then the rates look pretty dismal. Yeah. That's not actually how we normally count success. What we're counting success is that if you're looking at other diseases, we're looking at, is that person able to go back to functioning normally? Is that person's health improving? And what can happen is that, yeah, you might have someone who goes to rehab a few times and they keep relapsing, but that relapse is a setback, not a failure. It's a part of the journey of recovery that's to be expected, not something that shows a fundamental failure or flaw. And if you give people enough time, actually most people will recover from an opioid addiction. So Switzerland's a great example. They did something that, again, sounds crazy, but they had their own opioid crisis in the 90s, and they were trying to figure out what to do because the crime was rising. You know, the power of the drug dealers and the cartels that were involved was an issue, but then there's the petty crime of the people who are addicted, who are stealing in order to feed their addictions. It was a huge issue. And what they decided to do was to start diacetyl morphine treatment centers. And what you could do is if you had tried another system, if you tried and you were registered with the government that is like, all right, I'm trying to quit, you could qualify for treatment at a diacetyl morphine center. And so you'd go in the morning and you'd get an injection of diacetyl morphine in the morning and then one in the evening. And what they found was that with this diacetyl morphine treatment, I think it was over the course of 10 years, and I might need to fact check these numbers to get them exactly right. We can put them in the show notes.
I'll put the edit in the show notes.
It was, you know, about over 10 years, about 80% of the people who had been on this program had voluntarily left. Now, what's wild is diacetyl morphine is the pharmaceutical name for heroin. They were getting free heroin twice a day. Now, one of the misconceptions around opioids is that opioids themselves are incredibly dangerous. When I was on opioids, my life was not in danger. Right? I say on my book, you know, 120 people dying a day from opioid overdoses, one of them could have been me. One of them could have been me, not because of the prescription opioids I was on, because those I knew exactly how much they were and exactly what was in them.
Right.
And so my usage was controlled, and that is relatively rare of someone without any other medical conditions, without any other drugs in their system, to just overdose from prescription-grade opioids. It does happen, but it's not very common. What kills people is illicit opioids.
Right.
Because you don't know what's in them. You don't know how much is in them. And especially with these synthetic opioids like fentanyl and carfentanil, that's really what's driving the deaths today, is because you can have a few, many two grams in, you know, grains of fentanyl in your injection, and suddenly that's it, because there is not a regulation around it. So when you create that environment where, you know, it's not ideal, but it's better to keep that person alive and safe, because over time, every year that passes, there are more and more opportunities, there's more and more chances for that person to have some sort of breakthrough moment, or for that person to get the treatment that's just right for them, or for that person to get to a place where recovery is possible. And the greatest tragedy today is when I keep hearing the term accidental overdose and it drives me nuts. It's not accidental anymore, it's negligent.
Right.
If you keep having accidents at the same intersection in the same way, at some point you don't start just keep saying what's wrong with these drivers. You say what's wrong with the intersection. And we need to start asking what's wrong with our society, what's wrong with our public policy. There's other countries that have done this. We can't keep saying accidental. We need to say it's negligence. because we know it's wrong. We know it keeps happening, and we know there are alternatives, and they sound a little bit crazy sometimes. They sound counterintuitive, right? I admit this does not sound normally when you subsidize something, you get more of it.
Right.
And that's a typical way of how a market functions. But this is where the other term that's important is harm reduction. You have a syringe exchange, right? Where someone can go in and they can hand in their used needles and they can get back clean needles. So again, that sounds like you're subsidizing drug use. You're subsidizing the paraphernalia from it. How can that be a good idea? Well, what happens normally with syringe exchanges is I've been a part of these and volunteered. So you got somebody who shows up for the first time and they're looking down at the ground and they feel ashamed and they come and they get their syringes and they don't really want to talk. Time and time again, I saw it the next week. If you see the same person and they say hi, then they look at you and they realize they're not being judged and they realize it's a place of love and compassion. And then I had this multiple times. It was like by the third time someone goes, yeah, man, this is rough, but you don't know anything about it.
Mm.
And then I'd get to say, well, I don't know your story. And I know you probably had a lot more you've had to deal with than I have, but I know what it's like. It's not easy. And that's where the relationship comes in. And so they found that the people who use a syringe exchange are more likely to stop using drugs than those who aren't, because they're having regular contact with someone that cares about them, someone that cares about their health. And then they get to see the benefits. Because if they're in a rough spot and they've felt like their lives are out of control, suddenly they do something that's positive and they're able to see that their health is improving and they feel good about that. And that might be the step to say, actually, now I want to control my usage a little bit more. I want to reduce my usage. And those things are all possible. And in our old models of addiction, the idea of someone reducing their usage over time didn't really fit in.
Right.
But we have the evidence now that that's actually a very common way that people enter into recovery. That was my journey. I slowly reduced my usage over time as I learned to understand my own cravings, as I learned to have more response mechanisms, and I found healthier ways to address my own pain. That is not an unusual story anymore. We know that happens all the time. And that's where we need to allow for that diversity of experiences. Not everybody's change is going on the road to Damascus and suddenly Saul goes to Paul because they saw a blinding light and everything changes all at once. A lot of us have much more slow stories where the shifts in our lives happen as gentle nods of the soul as we try to find our home in God or that higher power that AA talks about. And those different kinds of experiences we need to create space for so that more people can enter into whatever that recovery looks like for them.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think that's really good. That's a powerful, powerful moment. And it occurs to me that you can say this stuff because of your experience in a way that like other people can't. And I think that's a valuable thing. It doesn't, make all that worth it or whatever, or rationalize those things, but it brings good out of that, like sort of that broken, reality, And it just occurred, like I have all these things swirling in my head, like our misunderstanding of like mental health, even like the role of trauma and, the role of, like you said, not having somebody who cares about you and this despair. And it also speaks to even our anthropology, like how we think about humans. People don't want to be addicts, like, or be lazy or be laying on the street. Like people want to work and contribute and like be a positive person in society. Right. But we get this idea that like, oh, they're just trying to get out of work and they're just lazy and we just vilify them and misunderstand mental health. And we get into an epidemic, yeah.
And that is, just our fundamental understanding of sin. Right. So for me, understanding like this idea of original sin, I love now the Eastern Orthodox language that I feel like is just enough of a shift that it's helped me is to think of as like inherited sin as opposed to original, because that still allows for the original blessing, right? That still allows for the tov that we see in Genesis 1, where it's, you know, and that's a Scott McKnight quote there, is he loves the tov, right? God said not just good, but very good, right? When we get that promise that we were created good, very good, I've actually gone back now, and I think my understanding of sin is, and I go back and I read Psalm 51, and I start to read that and replace the word sin sometimes for trauma. Mm. And so to say, like, in trauma, I was born into this world, and my trauma is always before me. And we, that little bit of a shift of understanding that, like, yeah, we inherit trauma. That's now, you know, scientifically verified,
right,
that you can inherit trauma and it lives in your DNA. That gives us both the, we were made good, but we have these traumatic experiences in our lives that tend us towards these mechanisms of defense. Mm. They tend us towards these mechanisms to try to ease the pain in our lives. And quite naturally, the learning systems of our brain, if we find a substance that can powerfully do that, our brains are tricked into thinking that we are answering the problem.
Right.
When in fact, we are temporarily addressing it. And that's where, you know, I go back and I now hear these stories of people who, you know, end up on the streets and try to reinterpret in my mind from, you made a terrible mistake, you're a bad, you know, that kind of narrative, to, man, you were in a tough spot and you reached for something you knew could provide you some temporary relief. And you tried to manage that the best way you knew how at the time. Now, that doesn't mean it's the best way to manage that, but it might have been the best way you knew at the time to address those things that were going on. And when we can start with that kind of compassion, that changes not just us, but that changes, I think, how people hear us when we talk to them. And one of the studies William Miller noted for me was that there have been multiple times where they've studied the tone of a doctor's voice that they use when addressing the alcohol use of a patient they're seeing can dramatically affect the outcome of whether or not that person keeps drinking. Mm. In fact, they did a three-site, multi-site study where trying to figure out what is the best evidence-based approach for addressing addiction. And they took a bunch of these leading approaches, all the best research, and they had all of these counselors who were working with different patients, and they were hoping to see, all right, what comes out on top? Do we have the right approach for addiction? And the results came in, and they were somewhat inconclusive. There wasn't a real, like, winner as far as the best results of people reducing their drug use, reducing harmful drug use. But what they did find was there is a dramatically different results inside of each methodology. And that was driven primarily by the empathy rating the counselor received by the researchers.
Wow.
And I hope that we stop thinking of addiction as this universal problem that will have a universal solution. Some people are in the AA tradition and that has worked for them. And that has been good. And other people, you know, if you're someone who's coming from a place of trauma, like Bill W. was a banker. He was a white dude banker at the top of his career. Like that for me, like being a young guy in Washington, D.C., being excited about my career, like I get the Bill W. approach of saying I need to learn to say I am not in control and that that's something that resonated with me. But if you're someone who was a native person who has moved off their lands and has been living in a reservation that has been ignored and underfunded and there's all of this trauma, or you're a woman who is growing up and was abused, maybe the first thing you need to learn is not powerlessness. Maybe you might need to hear that there is power inside of you, that there is good inside of you, that you have agency. As being created in the image of God, you have agency in this world. And we don't treat cancer as if, you know, radiation treatment is the universal solution. And if it doesn't work, we don't ask what's wrong with you. We say, all right, what's the next therapy we're going to try? What are the combinations of therapies that we're going to try to move this into remission? And I hope that's the mindset that we start to get to, of saying, your story is different than my story. So what you need might be different than what I need. And there are some people who might be in a place where they are using for a few years because that is the best they know how to do at that time. And we need to keep them as safe and as stable as possible when that is their reality. And then as we discover and as they grow and as they are directing for themselves, their own lives and the choices they want to make, we can find those different ways to support people in that journey of change.
That's good. That's really good stuff. I appreciate the work. What are the best places to sort of find you and the book and all of that stuff?
Yeah. So recently recorded an audiobook. So if you're on Audible, jump in there. And then of course, any of your independent bookstores, I'm doing my best to decrease my reliance on Amazon purchases.
Amen. Yes.
Supporting our,
so much,
our
yes.
local bookstore. And then one other great place to check out is the Center of Addiction and Faith. I'm a board member there. We now host monthly webinars. And so if you're interested in diving into these specific topics, once a month we get on with different experts to hear about different approaches to addiction, different threads of this broader conversation, how they fit together. It'd be great to have folks join us there.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, I'd still love to ask the final two questions if you're if you got time for me here.
Yeah.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Strangest job? I had a series. So I left DC about 5 or 6 years ago and bounced around Europe for a year. So I spent a couple months in Turkey milking goats and learning how to make goat cheese. Then worked on an olive grove for about a month, and then spent 3 months in Tuscany over in Italy working in an old castle making salumi. So we'd butcher up 3 pigs per week, make some great prosciutto, guanciale, finocchiona, salami. It was a real tough job. But somebody has to make the world's salumi.
That is incredible. I love that. Those are skills that just pay off, though, down the road, right? So, you know.
You know, I like to say I'm an uncle to a farm, so that means my brother has to run it and do all the day-to-day stuff, and I still get to be involved in its life. So he's started raising pigs, so we get to bring back those skills and have some nice local New Hampshire guanciale, lardo, and head cheese. Nothing like a good Tuscan head cheese.
I love it, man. That's awesome. That's incredible. Okay. So my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I'm going to answer this in line with our addiction conversation, because I do not doubt that there's at least some listener out there, because this is just percentages, who their own substance use has gone up over the course of this pandemic. And I want you to know first, that's okay. It's been a stressful year. And it makes sense that if you started drinking a little bit more, that makes sense. It's an understandable reaction. And now you also might be in a place where you're wondering what that means for you. And maybe your sleep isn't as good. Maybe you've been waking up feeling more tired. That is something that's happening with a lot of people right now. And if that's something that you're worried about, of how your own drinking or any other substance use is affecting your life, just take a deep breath, breathe in, breathe out. You're not a bad person. You're engaged in a very understandable response to a highly stressful situation. And then ask yourself, what do you want your life to look like? What do you want your ministry to look like? And to focus on that positive, to focus on what it is you are hoping to achieve in your life. And then ask again, where does your relationship with alcohol or any other substance fit in? And what do you think a healthy relationship looks like? And if that feels a little bit scary, as soon as you start to ask those questions, if you feel some sense of negative reaction or you feel a sense of defensiveness, don't worry about it. Try to feel those feelings and then also let them go, because that's not where you need to stay with that. And you don't need to make any dramatic decisions right now in the moment, but simply ask if you want that to change. And if you have been feeling it, one way to start is just take a week off. Just take a week off. If that seems challenging, if that seems too hard, then talk to somebody about it and say, I want to take a week off of drinking. Would you check in? You don't need to be my boss. You don't need to yell at me. Just, I want to take a week off and see how it feels. Because it is a misconception that there's this binary, that you either are addicted or you're not. It's a spectrum. And the earlier that you feel that and you can identify it and set healthier patterns, the easier it is to address. And so it's exactly when you might be looking and saying, there's not a lot of negative stuff in my life right now. I'm just not sleeping as well as I used to. That's a great time to address it, because that's one of those very early signs that there's something that's not fully healthy happening. And if that's a conversation that you can pull in someone who you trust and they understand, that's a great place to just start talking about it and to not worry about the binaries, not worry about a label, but just talk about where your usage is and where you'd like it to be, and see if you can set up a way to help yourself meet those goals. And there's a lot of great apps out there. There's apps like Drinker's Helper where you just start to record it and you can find a community of other people who are talking about the same things. Some people want to quit. Some people just want to reduce and feel healthier and lose a little bit of weight. And those are great conversations to be engaged in. And if there is anything that you are more worried about and that feels heavier to you, or that you feel some resistance inside, that might be a time to talk to somebody and to find a counselor and to feel okay bringing it up in a way that you aren't going to feel like you need to get rushed off to rehab right away. That's not normally how this works. It's normally talking about what's going on in your life and how you can make sure that the relationship you have with any substance in your life, whether it's caffeine, alcohol, marijuana, is something that you feel good about and is healthy and is contributing to a full life, as opposed to denigrating it or pulling away from it. And that's not a black or white. That's a spectrum. And have that conversation now.
Tim, that's good stuff. I really appreciate that. Dude, it was so great hanging out and talking and getting some of your wisdom here. I really appreciate it and the work all you got going on, man.
Great talking with you. Glad to be on.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Tim, and I just highly encourage you to check out this work he's got going on. Such good stuff. This is stuff we have to be talking about. It's not something that can stay out there. At some point, all of us will be affected by addiction, whether in ourselves or somebody else. And I just think we need to know how to think about this, what we're doing, and how we can bring about the greater good, the common good for all people. And so I highly encourage you to check out what Tim's got going on. This is a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there for me, just to let people know others are listening to the podcast and that it's awesome. I greatly appreciate that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.